Welcome to Songs of a Lifetime with me, writer and journalist Sally McElhone. Consider this podcast a musical photo album where I share with you my own personal music-related memories. Each week I'll cover a different track and the reasons why it's special to me. For anyone who has ever had a song completely capture a moment in time, this podcast is for you. By Soccer Mummy reminds me of Cass, my baby who never had a chance to be born. Let me explain. It was Boxing Day 2020 and I was walking through Tesco's with my then fiance, having just dropped my son over to his dad's place for their Christmas celebration. I was only a few weeks pregnant, and as we searched for some supplies, I felt this stabbing pain in my left ovary, like something inside me had exploded. I had to stop for a minute to catch my breath. But as quickly as the pain came, so too it recoiled, and I immediately started walking to the ladies' toilets, fearing the worst. I got there and there was nothing. No evidence of anything that was going wrong inside me. I put it down to a sluggish gut, constipation, my womb expanding, some normal pregnancy symptom that would be short-lived. But unbeknownst to me, that tiny explosion was my unborn baby stuck in the wrong place, growing too big for my fallopian tube and causing it to burst as my womb slowly filled up with blood. Internal bleeding isn't how they make it look in the movies. I carried on pretty much as normal. I was bloated, struggling with sleep, and had these uncomfortable cramps that came in waves, and when they were really going for it, felt worse than childbirth. In an attempt to get my guts moving, my fiancé and I even went for a walk around our local woods, scaling steep hills while I told him that I felt like my head was underwater. Boxing Day was Saturday, and it wasn't until Monday, the 28th of December, that I started to feel awful. I had a routine blood test at my local hospital around midday and was due to drive myself there. My husband was working, my dad was working too, so I contemplated asking my stepmum to come and take me to the hospital as I felt too rough to drive. But even with all the pain, I told myself I couldn't possibly make her travel for an hour just to drive me 15 minutes down the road. My tummy was all over the place, but I piled into my car and distracted myself with the radio and thoughts of my son on Christmas Day. I didn't know it then, but I wouldn't drive my car again for over a month. The nurse asked me how I was feeling, and I mentioned the cramps, the dizziness, this weird pain at the tip of my shoulder, this morning's diarrhea. Looking cheerful amid the concern, she hurriedly organised an emergency scan. 15 minutes later, I was on my back in a darkened room having an ultrasound. The consultant said the words, "free-flowing fluid," and the nurse grabbed my hand tightly in hers. I don't know much, but I knew that a nurse grabbing your hand in a pandemic is generally a bad sign. My pregnancy was ectopic, and I needed emergency surgery. When my first baby had flourished so easily, my second was tragically destined not to survive. I knew it was a possibility. In fact, on some level, I think I knew it wasn't meant to be. It felt different. From the beginning, something just wasn't quite right. I thought I was pregnant in late October 2020. It would have been mine and my husband's first month of properly trying for a baby. But I took a test and it was negative. No harm, no foul, I thought. There's always next month. My next period in late November was different. Every woman who has menstruated for more than 2 decades knows the signs that aren't flow is a coming. But this particular period was lighter, less painful, and a brighter red than normal. But I shrugged it off. Sometimes these things happen. Hormones, am I right? My husband and I were planning on getting married on the 9th of January 2021. We joked about the date being a day after his 40th birthday so he'd never forget our anniversary. A group of close friends organised a Zoom hen do on the 11th of December, as we were all deep into lockdown by this point, and after the festivities were wrapped up, in the middle of the night I woke up feeling nauseous. I took a pregnancy test the next day, which confirmed I was pregnant, maybe 1 or 2 weeks. I had spotting and cramps, same as I did with my first child. So I was sent to the doctor for a checkup, and she referred me to A&E. After hours of waiting there, a doctor pressed firmly across various parts of my tummy, and as she put pressure on the left-hand side, I yelped unexpectedly. The blood test came back, and an SHO who seemed to have had an emotion transplant told me mechanically that my hormone levels were very low. This meant that I was either very early days pregnant or that my baby was ectopic. From that point on, I had that shadow hanging over me. I was asked to return for more tests in a few days. On Christmas Eve, when the country was in tears and Christmas plans were being cancelled, we did get a chance to see my dad and stepmum, albeit with masks and social distancing. We needed emergency childcare so my husband and I could go back to the hospital for more tests. We had an ultrasound scan and nothing was visible. The baby could be too small to be seen, they said. Or... every conversation had the ectopic caveat. We returned home and tried to distract ourselves by playing with my then 2-year-old son, getting him excited about Santa's visit. The call came with the blood test results. What you hope to see in those early days is the hormone levels doubling every day. Mine were rising, but not as much as the doctors would expect. So I was booked in for more tests on Monday, the 28th of December. A date I now will forever associate with the loss of my second child. Christmas Eve night, I was pretty convinced that something was rotten in the state of Denmark. We FaceTimed my brother, an interventional radiologist who lives in New Zealand. He said I would have to be around 5 to 9 weeks pregnant for my ectopic signs to present themselves. And with my hormone levels being so low and my period a couple of weeks earlier, the timings were off. I trust my brother implicitly, so I breathed a temporary sigh of relief. What we didn't know was that my November period was in fact implantation bleeding. By the 28th of December, I was around 6 to 7 weeks pregnant. Prime ectopic real estate. Christmas Day 2020 was weird for everyone, especially being separated from friends and family after such a stressful year. But I felt uncharacteristically annoyed for someone who loves Christmas. I missed my family, I hated my own cooking, I was desperate for a large glass of red wine. My son enjoyed himself, but the whole thing just felt strange and uncomfortable, no matter how much we tried to make the best of it. Some part of me, on some subconscious level, just knew that things were gearing up for something hugely disappointing. It was that stunted calm before the storm. When the nurse grabbed my hand in the hospital, I was told I'd need to be prepped for emergency surgery. At that stage, they wouldn't tell me that my baby had died, just that they needed to put a camera inside me and see what was happening. I was moved into a side room with the consultant who was typing up notes as I sat texting my husband through floods of tears. He had literally no bedside manner and essentially ignored my unfolding trauma. I always think about that moment and laugh at the absurdity of it. I think he even got a call. Can't talk now, there's a woman here who could die. Oh yeah, did I not mention that? Of every 1,000 ectopic pregnancies in the UK, 2 people die. And I was petrified that I was about to be one of them. The good thing in all this madness was that, in the week or so leading up to my surgery, I was reading This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay, The Secret Diaries of a Junior Doctor. I had seen firsthand how my brother had been put through the ringer working for the NHS, and how his steely determination had got him to the position of consultant after years of late nights, missed meetups, and revision for exams on top of a full-time job. But Adam Kay's book spells out the harsh and hilarious realities of the world of medicine in more detail than my brother had ever been able to tell us over the dinner table. It was especially helpful because much of the book covered his time on the obs and gynae wards, including his handling of multiple ectopic pregnancies. It gave me comfort and made me feel like I might not die on the operating table because these people seemed to know what they were doing. My husband arrived and we sat in a side room while I chatted absolute nonsense at the nurse while she did my COVID test. Various doctors came in and when I asked if I would die, I was assured that they would take very good care of me. This sounded like a line every doctor throws out in situations such as these, and while I believed them, I was still shaking like I'd been electrocuted as I was whisked into the ward for surgery. I felt for my husband that day. Is it better for something tragic to happen to you, or to watch it happen to someone you love? There is no right answer. He walked beside my bed as I was wheeled down to theatre, and he told me later that he fell apart as the doors closed behind me. Hey, I've been falling apart. He was not allowed to visit me on the recovery ward or after my surgery at all, due to COVID. So from the moment I went through those doors, I was alone. It was 48 hours before we could properly support each other through what just happened. The camera found my ruptured fallopian tube and the consultant removed it and my baby from my womb. As I came to, he asked me if I'd like to see the tube and the baby. My one regret is that I said no. I was high as a kite and at that point I could only think of what had been removed as something that had tried to kill me. I didn't think of it as Cass, the baby I would never get to meet. Not that there might have been much to see, but still. Now all I have is my imagination. I'm going to be honest. In those early days I was just so relieved that I didn't die, that thinking about the baby didn't really feature. I was in excruciating pain the night after surgery as the painkillers wore off. My whole torso was in agony and I had to beg to be catheterised because it was too painful to move myself onto the commode. Now people may roll their eyes at me on that one, but I did my first childbirth on gas and air only and got to 7 centimetres dilated without any fuss. They were actually going to send me home because they didn't believe I was in labour. I was that calm. So I know pain, I just usually know how to manage it. This pain could not be managed. The catheter and the morphine definitely helped. It was difficult being on the ward. There was a woman who had fallen in the shower and broken her hip, another whose husband had attacked her and broken her back. Of course, you can hear everyone's conversations because you're only separated by a curtain. Then there were a few old dears. One who said nothing but smiled from ear to ear every time she was rolled past. I spent my days trying to sleep or connecting with the world on Instagram. The only way I know how to deal with things is to be open, so I spilled the sorry tale on my stories, and I was surprised quite how many women I knew came back to say they'd been through something similar. There were plenty of miscarriages, but plenty of ectopic pregnancies too. One friend had hers medically managed, a process where you were given a drug to stop the pregnancy growing and eventually miscarry. Others had the same procedure as me. I began to feel less alone. Women are brilliant at raising each other up in situations such as these. Reaching out and helping others on social media is quick and costs nothing, but the benefits of a message can last a lifetime. I am so grateful for the wonderful women on my Insta. What about Soccer Mummy? Where does she feature in all this? My husband had put the album on in the car while we were driving somewhere. I want to say it was around November 2020, before all this happened. It was as though, rather than pushing the album on me, he wanted it to speak for itself. And speak it did. Loved the melodies, and Sophie Allison's voice gave me waves of Dawson's Creek soundtrack mid-90s nostalgia. It washed over me the first few times, with no song in particular catching me in its grip. It was when I got home, and my husband and I had to face our grief, that Circle the Drain became a lifeline. It seemed to perfectly encapsulate that feeling of my joy of being alive being replaced by the creeping dread of grief. Things feel that low sometimes. Even when everything is fine. It's an incredibly beautiful song about depression that tapped into how I was feeling about loss. The chorus melody feels so delicate and upbeat, but the words behind it are so brutal and honest. It echoed my feelings of hitting rock bottom emotionally, but there being an expectation from many who were close to me that I should dust myself off and keep going. And I did do that. I returned to work after 2 weeks of physical recovery, despite probably needing another two to recover mentally. And I listened to Circle the Drain on repeat. Alison was the only person, other than my husband, who got it. She told NPR, "That's what happens with people a lot of the time. The outside can be going through life like normal, and then the inside is struggling." That's exactly where I was at. My boss at the time had asked me what he should tell the team. And I told him he should be honest. I said it in a much more direct way, and unfortunately, he didn't really listen to me. I'm sure he did his best, and a handful of people knew and reached out, including a colleague who had been through something similar, and her near-daily check-ins were so incredibly restorative. But for every great person, there was someone who thought I had just been off for my wedding, which was soon to be postponed another 3 times. Or, even better, someone who would email saying, "So sorry to hear your news. Could you just proofread this document, please?" The song makes use of bubble sound effects, and that's how my husband and I felt. Like we were in this little bubble of grief against the world. We got some therapy through his job, and so when people close to us said unhelpful things, we had a space in which to lay ourselves bare. On top of the grief, we had to deal with the reactions and opinions of others, which weighed heavy. My anxiety was through the roof, and when people acted like we should move on or get over it, I took that pretty badly. It made me angry, upset, and feel incredibly alienated. Similarly, a person close to us compared ectopic pregnancy to miscarriage without recognising that each form of loss affects people differently. There is no rule to say that it's better to miscarry than have an ectopic. They are both traumatic, and there is really nothing to be gained by comparing the two in a twisted competition over who has suffered more. That's not to say that everyone was unsupportive. The dismissive voices were in the minority. It's just that their effects were felt more deeply. Various female friends were so kind, sending flowers, care packages, sweet treats, cosy blankets, soft PJs and scented candles. I can say hand on heart that I have the best friends in the world, and I can't thank them enough for helping me get through that time. On one of my toughest days, I unexpectedly bonded with my elderly Nana. I didn't want to burden her with my feelings because she seems to feel the pain of her children and grandchildren as if it were her own. And no one wants to make an 89-year-old cry. But I think it was helpful for both of us. My Nana lost her 2-year-old sister to TB when she was still a child herself. She described how her sister went into hospital one day, and then she never saw her again. At that time, of course, nobody talked about grief and mental health the way we do now. Nana was expected to just carry on as if nothing happened. But it clearly still affects her to this day. I also found it difficult to know what to say to my then 2-year-old son. I told him that the doctors found something in my tummy that was making me sick, and they had to take it out. The truth, sort of. He would ask to see my scars each time he saw me, almost like he was processing my healing at the same time as I was. When my son was with his dad, my husband and I decided it would be helpful to us to hold a little funeral. to pay tribute to what might have been and to honour our loss. We wore black and wrote letters to our unborn child who we had named Cass. My sister-in-law had mentioned our little star in our Christmas card, and the name Cassiopeia came into my head after the constellation. This seemed like a fitting name and a nice, neutral, shortened version to suit a baby of unknown gender. Around the same time, my amazing baker friend Fatima sent me a bracelet, a small silver star on a red cord, along with a selection of uplifting edibles. Now, I'm not super religious, but I do believe in signs sent by the universe, and to me, the bracelet represented my little star. I haven't taken it off since. Whenever I'm struggling with something, I turn the star over in my fingers and I talk to my child. It's a constant reminder that Cass is always with me, no matter what. Throughout everything, I felt terrible for my husband. I had my son, and he did too, but his first experience of pregnancy and birth was the loss of a potential child. As we were writing our letters, he broke down and said, "How do you say goodbye to someone you never met?" I felt like I'd failed my husband, and that my body had failed me. My body that had so easily produced a baby with the wrong person couldn't just work when I'd found the right person. I felt guilty, like I was a disappointment to everyone, but especially my husband and his family. No one else felt like that, of course, but depression tells you that you're worthless and hateful and everyone would be better off without you. It's taken lots of work and self-reflection to move past that. We burned our letters in a black ceramic urn in the garden and did very little for the rest of the day. We gave ourselves time, weeks and months of it, and eventually things got better. We've been trying again recently, so far unsuccessfully, which I've realised is fine, because it's not in my control. I can't wish us pregnant. I can only hope that one day we will get luckier than last time. When I came to after the surgery, one of the first people I spoke to was a nurse who had been through exactly the same procedure. 2 years later, she gave birth to a daughter. "The same will happen for you," she said. "I know it." Maybe it will. Maybe it won't. But what this experience has taught me is to appreciate everything I have now. I'm alive, I'm healthy, everyone in my family is healthy. I'm married to the sexiest nerd on the planet and I have the coolest kid ever. Life is good. As long as I have them, I'm golden. So thank you, Sophie Allison, for helping me grieve at my own pace. For giving me a safe space within the world and within myself to be sad. For showing me that I didn't have to fake it, because faking it actually makes everything worse. If something hurts, let it hurt, because that's okay. It means it meant something. Thank you also for writing a song that's so uplifting, that acknowledges the pain of falling apart and having your heart split open, while still feeling the joy in life. There are beautiful images in the song that you can't help but smile at. And the melody seems, to me, to promise that things will get better. If you've been affected by anything in this podcast, contact the Miscarriage Association, the Ectopic Trust, or Tommy's. They are all amazing resources which are guaranteed to help anyone going through a pregnancy loss. My final word, go and read This Is Going to Hurt by Adam Kay. And be nice to every NHS worker you meet until the end of eternity. Their job is to bear witness to every peak and trough of the human experience, day in, day out. They deserve to be rewarded for that. If you can't affect how much they're paid, the least you can do is be kind. Thank you for listening.